Welcome back to another episode of Good Sentences. I know it's been a while since we've been here, and I do apologize for that. Scott and I have been quite busy doing other amazing things, like, I don't know, small things, like finishing up a new book, for example.
We have been actively doing what it is we talk about here on Good Sentences, which is writing a book. What's the saying? Those who can do, those who can't teach, and those who really suck, have a podcast about it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much how I remember that saying going. And Ben Franklin, I think, came up with that one.
Yes, it was, and such foresight on his part. Envisioned podcasts in the
only
era
founding
the
father
internet.
To have had a podcast. Can you imagine, though, what it would have been like back then if the founding fathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, actually had podcasts?
That would be insane. It would be like probably very disillusioning to us in the 21st century, because they probably, one of them at least, probably sounded like a rat when he talked. I'm thinking maybe Button Gwinnett. All the obscure signers of the revolution, the Declaration of Independence, were actually like mutants, you know.
Right. Hey, I'm Button Gwinnett, and I'm here to sign this piece of paper you have.
Thomas Jefferson's like, and today on the show we have George Washington as our special guest. Hello, George.
How you doing?
Hey, Don. It's a good time at your place, Lynn.
I gotta tell you that George Cornwallis, he didn't stand a chance of gonna whip his ass.
Well, he did have smallpox, so I mean, maybe it affected his vocal cords. And like Ben Franklin was screamingly effeminate or something like that. Early to bed, oh God, yes. And early to rise, if you know what I mean.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, what?
God, we're idiots.
Holy shit. None of this is going to actually make the final cut, but I'm loving it. Well, that went off the rails.
You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts, neither of whom listened to dear old mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
Right. We've gone about as far afield as we could have gone.
But watch this beautiful segue, how I bring it back in order to finalize the Declaration of Independence, some co-authoring was required.
Oh, I like that.
Whoa, where did he get that from? I don't either, but let's talk about co-authoring now that I've mentioned it.
Yeah, may as well.
Out of the blue, you know.
Now, Scott and I know something about co-authoring because we've done a lot of it. We've worked on the Spyco novella series together. And then more recently, Scott has come on board to help me out with the Shelby Alexander thriller series. And as I mentioned before, we've just finished writing our first Serenity book together, Serenity Reborn, available now for pre-order, by the way. I'm pretty excited about it. It's one of the best projects I've been a part of. So I'm excited to get it out there amongst the wild.
It was almost from the beginning, it felt special as we were working on it. I'm speaking for me, and I know that you've said that privately to me, that it definitely felt different to you as well. Right. So we do know a little bit about co-authoring, but what I quickly learned was that not everybody had the same experience we had. I reached out. Craig and I will be appearing on April 4th at the North Iowa Book Bash, and we have a couple of Facebook pages connecting us both to the folks that are going to be attending, and one just for the authors to do devious things like I did yesterday, which was to put up a little poll asking the 60 or so folks that are going to be sitting at tables at this event what their previous experience has been with co-authoring, if any, and did they enjoy it? Would they do it again? And then I asked them for comments in addition to just answering the poll. We got 9 folks who said that they have in the past and definitely would again, 7 who said they never have but would like to, and actually only got 1 response of someone who said they had and never would again. All of those are very valid responses, because everybody's experience is going to be a little bit different. And depending on who you're writing with, it could be an extremely rewarding experience, or it could be very challenging, Craig and I were extremely lucky to find out quickly that we worked incredibly well together. We just seemed to, well, we have a similar style, which helps because we're trying to write a unified book, you know, trading chapters or multiple chapters or whatever. If Craig wrote like a Victorian author and I wrote like a crime noir author, it probably wouldn't work that well. We were able to overcome any, you know, any rough edge differences, and we work really well. I don't think there's a ton of ego when we write. And so that works well for us because if I've written a chapter and Craig goes in and makes changes in it, I recognize immediately this is better now. And it's the same way when I go through, you know, something that Craig's written and I say, okay, this might ramp things up if I add a sentence here, or this might, you know, get us a chuckle if I add a sentence here. So for us, it was almost immediately, you know, a very, I guess what was the first one we actually worked on together was probably Istanbul, right?
Yep. And I mean,
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, you're. I wouldn't dream. There are a couple of key things, and you touched on it, and that is that ego has no real place when it comes to a co-authoring project.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got one person who, you know, their ego enters a room before they do, it's so big, and then you have one other person who isn't so much, it might work if the other person is willing to take a back seat constantly. But even in that, they're going to get tired of it. But if you've got two people with major egos in terms of their writing, at least, it's not going to work.
Yeah, I can't see any way it could, really.
No, it would be a nightmare. Scott was so correct when he said that he and I are lucky to have found one another for co-authoring, because I think it's a lot more rare than perhaps we might think initially for not only people to try it, but for it to work successfully. Yeah, I think we got one response only where it was somebody had tried it, wouldn't try it again. Uh-huh. But I would hazard a guess that number is actually a lot higher.
Yeah,
but you can't say that because your co-author is probably looking at the same poll.
Yeah, exactly.
They would know who you were talking about.
Can you imagine being the person who co-wrote with that one person and reading this poll?
But I thought we were friends.
When we first discussed it, I will admit I had a little trepidation. That's a big step the first time, because you really don't know until you start doing it how it's going to work. One of the things I noticed in some of the comments that we got on the poll, a lot of people go about it differently than you and I do. This one here said, I've co-authored with two different authors and both were great experience. We discussed some ideas and then just went with the flow, which is very similar to what you and I do. Mm-hmm. One of us writing a few chapters and then sending it to the other to write the next few. Smooth it out. Each person went back and edited chapters from the other author, which helped make it flow easily and blend our writing styles together. That's almost exactly what we do. Yeah. Another person said she actually has co-authored in three different pairings, or in one case, it looks like three of them worked together. She talked about how for her, it was really good because if she got stuck, the co-author often had a good idea that would unstick it. And that's happened with you and I more than once.
Yep.
She said, I love that my co-author's weaknesses are my strengths and their strengths help cover my weaknesses. And then she was also referring in this partnership specifically that they write in a dual point of view. So one author always has one character's point of view, the other has another. And she said, I love how having someone else who wants to read the next chapter motivates me to work on it, which again, I actually responded to her because we were talking on Messenger by this point. And I said how for you and I, getting that message that says, the book's back in the drive waiting for you, always, always, always elicits the same response from whoever the other person is, which is, you know, but literally, I can't wait to see what you've done every time you've done it. Now, another interesting method for co-authoring, our good friend David Behrens talked about when you interviewed him back on the Games and Writers show, where in his case, it's more another author using his character or an ancillary character that might not have actually appeared in David's work, but is a logical character to appear in his world, you know, and then basically he'll go through afterwards and look what the other author has written, make any changes he thinks needs to be made, and their two names go on the cover.
He's created a great universe there with a Troy Bodine series.
Oh, really fun stuff.
Definitely. And it takes place in the same geographical area as My Night at Key West, although not the same time period. But same kind of stuff. He's fascinated by that part of the world, as am I. And his stuff is so much fun to read. Zany, funny, really great characters. His character names are great.
I love that. I actually put that in my notes that he often uses road signs. I thought that was brilliant.
And especially since if your readers are people who live around that area, they'll recognize those, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about that while I was out driving the other day. I'm like, all right, let's run a little experiment. And the first street sign I came to was for a place called Dingle Hole Road. Maybe around here.
Arthur
Johnny
Dingle
Hole.
Talking about going back to the Founding Fathers, I've decided that I'm going to make my life a lot easier and just name all my characters after famous historical figures. Like Shelby Alexander is now going to be George Washington. Jerry McIntyre can be, you know, John Adams. I don't think anybody will notice. Do you? I think it'll work out.
It'll be seamless.
It'll feel familiar, but they won't know why.
And on the next cover, everybody's wearing powdered wigs.
They're like, oh, a historical mystery. Not at all.
No, they're just a bunch of guys in 2020 dressing up like founding fathers.
We won't explain it at all.
No,
just go with it.
Just happens. Shelby Alexander stormed into Independence Hall.
It's like what you call those anachronisms or something. I was reading this one book, and it was supposed to be historical in nature and set in the Revolutionary War.
Right.
And they were having a party with some British officers in the colonies, 1776, 7, whatever. And they wanted to dance. So they put a record on the phonograph. I'm like, what the hell is happening right here? It sort of blew my mind. And I started questioning myself. You know, am I wrong?
Right.
they wouldn't have had that. What is happening? But you got to be careful with those historical references every time.
You would at least think one of them would have looked at their cell phones to see if they were allowed to have a record player, you know? I mean, you talk to young people now and say the word compact disc and they look at you like you're, you know, already dead.
My CD collection, right?
Yeah. Like, who owns music anymore, man? You just stream it. Why you buy it and fill up your house with crap?
Yeah. Well, you just wait till all your streaming services crash because the cloud can't handle any more data, and I'll be the only one with music.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, I think we've babbled on long enough. I really want to get down back to this interview with David Behrens, which will start right now.
David F. Behrens has traveled up and down the East Coast and has been a tourist at every beach from Key West to Pawleys Island. Today, he calls Knoxville, Tennessee, home, but constantly dreams of sun and sand and ocean breezes. He has a beautiful wife, a rambunctious little girl, and a happy little boy who remind him daily of why he is alive. Someday, he hopes he'll be able to enjoy writing his books with a view of the ocean. David Behrens joins us now. David, thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely, Craig. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's talk a little bit about your journey to becoming a writer. Is this something you've always wanted to do, or is it something you discovered a little bit later in life?
I grew up being a writer. And I think right behind me, somewhere on that shelf there, I have a couple of books that I made when I was like 5 and 6 years old. I mean, I made them out of cardboard and paper and drew up little pictures and things like that. And luckily, my mom kept them and found them in the attic one day. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So I really did want to be a writer. You know? But and I went to school for English. Not that that has anything to do with writing, but I ended up somehow accidentally becoming a tennis professional. And that's what I kind of do for my living. Mm-hmm. And never really understood that you could write and make a living at it. And, you know, I did the whole agents, publishers, and, you know, never got anywhere. And, you know, it's understandable. There was a gatekeeper that I wasn't good enough for yet. And maybe I'm still working on getting past. But it was one of those situations where Kindle kind of came along and opened up the door. And I started writing again and putting things out and started reading.
Your series features a main character named Troy Bodine. Tell us a little bit about that character. For example, if you were going to introduce him to me at a dinner party, what would you say?
You know, I always say that Troy is somewhere between like a Magnum PI kind of guy, Tom Selleck kind of guy, with maybe a little bit of Matthew McConaughey kind of rolled in there. He's got like a drawl, and you know, he's one of those guys that all he really wants to do is go fishing, and he keeps getting messed up in these stories that I throw him into. And I sort of wanted to create an anti-hero a little bit. And I read Reacher and you know, Jack Reacher and some of those guys, and Vince Flynn's Mitch Rapp and all that. And so I kind of like those books, but I do also like the Florida fiction writing that is zany and a little off the wall. And, you know, I thought, man, that's really, I would like to go that way instead of the perfect, you know, sort of spy thriller guy who is always perfect and, you know, always gets his man and all that kind of thing. So he's kind of this creation that when I went to Pawleys Island the very first time, or maybe it was the second time, it was 2012, and Hurricane Debbie, which became Tropical Storm Debbie, kind of kept us inside. And we were all sitting at the table playing cards and everything, and we could see this guy fishing outside on the dock next to us. And he had a cowboy hat on, and he had these, you know, sunglasses, this pouring rain. And the guy's out there, you know, no shirt, khaki shorts, fishing. And he had this big dark black beard and dark hair. And I mean, I was like, oh man, this guy is a character. And we started just kind of, you know, spitballing who this guy is and what he's out there doing. And all of a sudden Troy Bodine was born. So it's pretty interesting.
So talking about characters, you know, you write thrillers, and those are often thought of as more plot driven, but you also have a bevy of great characters in your work. Do you consider your books more character or plot driven?
Ooh, they started out as character driven by far. Mm-hmm. In fact, the first book is really a lot of scenes with crazy characters that I linked together. You know, I drew them together with just a crazy outlandish plot line that this huge cashier's check, $7 million cashier's check, is stuck in this hat, and Troy finds the hat. Well, now there's all these characters who want the hat. It was an opportunity for me to draw on some pretty wild caricatures to have them chasing him around and trying to get this money. So it's definitely character driven. And then I learned what beat sheets were and outlines and things like that. And so I started getting more and more plot driven, which I think has helped. Definitely has a more solid plot. So I think it's getting more and more storytelling and less character driven.
I understand you've recently embarked on a writing partnership with, is it Steve Moore?
That's correct. Yeah. Stephen Moore is, he writes the Hiram Kane series, which is sort of got a dark noir Japanese detective kind of feel to it. I've known about Steve peripherally for a long time. In fact, I used him as an editor for a couple of my books.
Okay.
And we've literally never met face to face, but I know his writing and I know he's really good. And I've read two or three of his books too. They're not even really in my kind of genre, but I mean, they're really, really good. I really literally just put out the feelers to say, you know, I've got these other characters that I'd like to do something with, but I just don't have the time. You know, I do work actually a real, quote, real job, if you can call teaching tennis a real job, but
well, that
I sort
would
of
exhaust
have to
me.
It can be exhausting. So I reached out and said, would anybody like to tag team with me? And I can, you know, help you with beats and come up with plot lines and things like that and tell you who this character is and what informs them and why they would make a great series. And Steve wrote me and said, I want one. You know, I want one. Whatever it is, I want to do it. And so I went through two or three characters with him and said, okay, you know, here's one possibility. Here's another possibility. And he was like, well, I want both of those. Oh, okay. So he's actually working on, behind the scenes, he's working on two series. But the first that will come out will be Troy's brother, Ryan. And that will have a little more of an archaeological sort of dive type, go after sunken treasure feel to it. So it'll have some of the same zaniness, but it'll have a nice twist on it that it's not crime thriller based. It's more archaeological thriller based. So it's going to be pretty cool. Yeah, I've read most of his first prequel for that series, and it's really miraculous because it sounds like I could have written it.
What is the first experience you remember that made you realize that words had actual power and weren't just markings on a page?
My dad has always had a library. He's always had many, many books. And I can remember going through his bookshelf and finding books at a young age, maybe 11, 12 years old, that were quote, you know, adult books, you know, not adult, but like written for an adult person.
Right.
And, you know, and the writer, Piers Anthony, who is a very sort of, I guess, mid-lister fantasy, but still sometimes New York Times bestselling author guy, writes a series called the Xanth series, X-A-N-T-H. And I grabbed the first one and it just blew me away. The whole story, the way it started, and it surprised you, and it kind of has a, there's a magical land that is in Florida. And so I think maybe that's the genesis of my whole Florida obsession.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a parallel Florida that is the land of Xanth. So everything that's a landmark in Florida, there's a landmark in Xanth that correlates. The series is, I don't know, 40 books long or something crazy now. And I've read every one of them, and I go back, and it's, I don't really read a whole lot of magical fiction anymore. And I'll make time to go get that one. And so I think that's the genesis. That's the series and the words that struck me so powerfully. I think that was, you know, maybe 11, 12 years old. And then of course, eventually I went into Lord of the Rings and things like that.
Right.
And as my tastes changed, I got into the Lee Child's series. I don't read them all. My brother and I trade Robert B. Parker books back and forth. So I haven't read all of those, but that sort of crime fiction with noir and maybe a little bit of humor. And then I found Carl Hiaasen, and that's a weird story too. I used to live in Isla Mirada, and Carl Hiaasen lives on Isla Mirada, which is halfway down the Keys.
Okay.
He was a tennis member at the Isla Mirada Tennis Club while I was there. Didn't know who he was, had no idea he was a writer, had no idea he was a, and so I left. Years later, I find this book, Carl Hiaasen, and I go, wait a minute, is this the same guy? And I looked it up. Yep, that's him. No clue. I could have been taking notes from Carl Hiaasen on the court. But, I started reading his books, and those just, they blew me away too. So it was that second experience where every word he wrote was just hysterical to me and it made so much sense. And when I started writing, I was like, that's what I want to do.